In 1935, after studying data on human structural limits, Cunningham's legendary coach proclaimed it impossible. "The fastest a human could run a mile," he wrote, "was 4 minutes, 1.6 seconds. Pete disagreed. He was certain Louis had a 4-minute mile in him. Louis had always laughed this off, but in May of 1938 he reconsidered. His coach forbade him to run hills in the mistaken belief it would damage his heart. But Louis didn't buy the warnings. Every night he climbed the Los Angeles Coliseum fence and ran the stairs until his legs went numb. By June his body was humming, capable of speed and stamina beyond anything he'd ever known. He began to think Pete was right, and he wasn't alone. Running experts published articles suggesting Louis could be the first 4-minute man. Even Cunningham agreed. In June, Louis arrived at the National Collegiate Athletic Association, NCAA, championships in Minneapolis. Gushing with confidence, he babbled to everyone about his training, his strategy, and how he was gunning for 4 minutes. Word spread that Louis was primed for an epic performance. On the night before the race, a coach visited Louis, his face grim. He said other coaches were ordering their runners to injure Louis. Louis dismissed him, certain no one would do such a thing. He was wrong. Halfway through the race, just as Louis was about to take the lead, several runners shouldered in around him, boxing him in. The man beside him swerved and stomped on his foot, impaling Louis's toe with his spike. Then the man in front kicked back, cutting Louis's shins. A third man elbowed Louis's chest so hard he cracked Louis's rib. The crowd gasped. Bleeding and in pain, Louis was trapped for a lap and a half. He ran in the cluster of men, restraining his stride to avoid running into the man ahead. At last, nearing the final turn, he saw a tiny gap. He burst through, sprinted to the lead, and with his shins streaming blood and his chest aching, won easily. He slowed to a halt, bitter and frustrated. When his coach asked him how fast he thought he'd gone, he said he couldn't have beaten 4:20. The race time was posted. From the stands came a whoo. Louis had run the mile in 4 minutes, 8.3 seconds. It was the 5th fastest outdoor mile ever run, missing the world record by 1.9 seconds. His time would stand as an NCAA record for 15 years. Weeks later, Japan withdrew as Olympic host, and the 1940 Games were transferred to Finland. Louis rolled on, winning every race in the 1939 school season. In early 1940, in indoor miles against America's best runners, he was magnificent, twice beating Cunningham and getting progressively faster. In February, he ran a 4 minute 8.2 seconds, 6-tenths of a second short of the fastest indoor mile ever run. 2 weeks later, he scorched a 4 minute 7.9 seconds. With the Olympics months away, Louis was peaking at the ideal moment. Far away, history was turning. In Europe, Hitler was preparing to conquer the continent. In Asia, Japan's leaders had designs of equal magnitude. Poor in natural resources, its economy floundering, Japan was struggling to support a growing population. Eyeing their nation's resource-rich neighbors, Japan's leaders saw the prospect of economic independence, and more. Central to the Japanese identity was the belief that the Japanese were mankind's superior race, with the divine right to rule inferior Asians. Moved by economic need and a sense of destiny, Japan's leaders planned to conquer the Far East. For decades, Japan's military-dominated government had been preparing for its quest, crafting a muscular army and navy, and through a military-run school system that violently drilled children on Japan's imperial destiny, shaping its people for war. Most ominously, its army encouraged and celebrated extreme brutality in soldiers. In the late 1930s, Germany and Japan were ready. In 1937, Japan sent its armies smashing into China. 2 years later, Hitler invaded Poland, and war began in Europe. America was pulled into both conflicts. In Europe, its allies lay in Hitler's path. In the Pacific, its ally China was being ravaged by the Japanese, and its territories of Hawaii, Wake, Guam, and Midway, as well as its Commonwealth of the Philippines, were threatened. The world was falling into catastrophe. On a dark day in April 1940, the crisis reached into Louis's life. Hitler and his Soviet allies had unleashed their armies on Europe, and the continent was exploding into total war. Finland was reeling, her Olympic stadium partially collapsed by Soviet bombs. The Olympics had been canceled. Louis spent the summer of 1940 working as an aircraft factory welder and mourning his lost Olympics. America slid toward war. In Europe, Germany was routing America's allies. In the Pacific, Japan was tearing through China and moving into mainland Southeast Asia. To stop Japan, President Franklin Roosevelt declared an embargo, a trade ban, on war-making materials. Soon, he'd declare an oil embargo, freeze Japanese assets in America, and finally ban all trade with Japan. Still, Japan stormed onward. Watching fighter planes soaring over his work hangar, Louis felt a pull. He was still feeling it when Congress passed a bill requiring all young men to register for the military draft. Those who enlisted before being drafted could choose their service branch. Louis joined the Army Air Corps. In November 1941, he arrived at a flight school in Houston. The Air Corps was making him a bombardier. Early on a Sunday morning a few weeks later, a pilot guided a small plane over the Pacific. Below, a dark sea gave way to a strand of white, waves slapping Hawaii's Oahu Island. Below, Pearl Harbor, headquarters of the United States Pacific Fleet, was beginning to stir. At Hickam Field, soldiers were washing a car. At the officers' club, men were wrapping up a poker game. In a barracks, two men were having a pillow fight. Outside, a sergeant was peering through a camera lens at his son. Many sailors were sleeping in the warships swaying in the harbor. On the deck of the USS Arizona, men were assembling to raise flags, a Sunday morning tradition. Far above them, the pilot sent a flare skidding green across the sky. Behind him, 180 warplanes emblazoned with Japan's Red Circle emblem dove for Pearl Harbor. On the Arizona, the men looked up. In the barracks, one of the men in the pillow fight suddenly collapsed. He was dead, a 3-inch hole blown through his neck. His friend ran to a window and saw a building heave upward and crumble down. A dive bomber had crashed straight into it. There were red circles on its wings. In Texas, Louis was in a theater watching a matinee. The screen went blank. Light flooded the theater and a man hurried forward. "Is there a fire?" Louis thought. "Servicemen must return to their bases," the man said. "Japan has attacked Pearl Harbor." Louis sat there, eyes wide, mind fumbling. America was at war. He grabbed his hat and ran from the building. Part 2. Chapter 6. The Flying Coffin. As Japanese planes dove over Oahu, some 2,000 miles west, Marines were sitting in a tent on Wake Atoll eating pancakes. The tiny atoll, a strategically critical airbase, was home to about 500 bored American servicemen, mostly Marines. Nothing interesting ever happened there. But that morning, as the Marines started on their pancakes, a siren began wailing. Soon the sky was streaked with Japanese bombers. Buildings were exploding, and a few startled men found themselves on the front in the Second World War. All over the Pacific that morning, the story was the same. In less than 2 hours over Pearl Harbor, Japan mauled America's Navy and killed more than 2,400 people. Almost simultaneously, it attacked Thailand, Shanghai, Malaya, the Philippines, Guam, Midway, and Wake. In one day of breathtaking violence, Japan's main onslaught had begun. In America, invasion was expected at any moment. Less than an hour after Japan bombed Hawaii, mines were laid in San Francisco Bay. In Washington, D.C., the civil defense minister looped around in a police car, sirens blaring, shouting, "Calm!" into a loudspeaker. At the White House, a butler heard the president speculating on what he'd do if Japanese forces advanced as far as Chicago. First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt wrote to her daughter, urging her to flee the West Coast. In subsequent days, trenches were dug along California beaches, windows across America were draped in blackout curtains, and bridges, tunnels, and factories were put under guard. In Nebraska, citizens were taught to disable firebombs with garden hoses. Japan galloped over the globe, invading the Philippines, Guam, Burma, Borneo, Rabaul, Hong Kong, Singapore. But Wake wouldn't give in. The Japanese bombed and strafed it for days, then launched a massive invasion attempt. The little group of defenders shoved them back. It wasn't until December 23rd that Japan finally captured Wake and the men on it. For days, the captives were held on the airfield, singing Christmas carols to cheer themselves as the Japanese made plans to execute them. Then plans were changed. Most captives were forced onto ships bound for Japan and occupied China as prisoners of war, POWs. 98 men were kept on Wake. The Japanese enslaved them. In August 1942, Louis graduated from flight school as an officer, a second lieutenant. He drove to Torrance to say goodbye to his family before heading into his final round of training, then to war. Before he left, his family gathered on their front steps for a last photograph. Louis put his arm around his mother, who was fighting back tears. His father rode with him to the train station, crowded with uniformed young men and crying parents. Embracing his father, Louis could feel him shaking. As his train pulled away, Louis looked back. His father stood with his hand up, a wavering smile on his face. Louis wondered if he'd ever see him again. The train carried him to Ephrata, Washington, where an airbase sat in a dry lake bed. The lake bed was determined to bury the base in blowing dirt, and it was succeeding. Men waded through drifts more than a foot deep. All the meals were gritty with sand, and ground crews, which had to replace 24 dirt-clogged aircraft engines in 21 days, had to spray oil on the taxiways to keep the dust down. Louis was standing in the dust, sweating, when a man walked up and introduced himself. He was Russell Allen Phillips. He would be Louis's pilot. The son of an Indiana pastor, Phillips was small, built like a fireplug. A gentle, generous-hearted young man, he was so quiet he could be in a room for hours before anyone noticed him. He had one consuming passion. Back home, where everyone called him Alan, he'd met a girl from the church choir, Cessie Perry. She had a curvy figure, a buoyant disposition, a quick mind, and a family cat named Chopper. At a prom in Terre Haute, Alan kissed Cessie. He was a goner, and so was she. On a Saturday night in November 1941, when he left for the Air Corps, Phillips spent 5 last minutes with Cessie at the Indianapolis train station. When the fighting was over, he promised he'd make her his bride. In Ephrata, Louis and Phillips became best friends. Phillips floated along in Louis's chatty good humor. Louis liked Phillips' quiet, kind steadiness. He called Louis Zamp. Louis called him Phil. They never had an argument, and were almost never apart. The rest of Phil's bomber crew assembled. The top turret gunner and engineer was Stanley Pillsbury. The other engineer was Clarence Douglas, who manned one of the two waste guns behind the wings. The navigator and nose gunner was Robert Mitchell. Frank Glassman was the belly gunner. Ray Lambert was the tail gunner. The radio man and second waste gunner was Harry Brooks. The co-pilot was George Mosnett, Jr. Together, they'd be crew number 8 in the 9-crew 372nd Bomb Squadron. All the men were bachelors, but Harry Brooks, like Phil, had a steady girl back home. Her name was Jeanette, and she and Harry had set their wedding date for May 8, 1943. All the crew needed was a plane. Everyone was hoping to be assigned to a B-17, a handsome, fiercely armed, practically indestructible bomber. The plane no one wanted was a giant new plane, Consolidated Aircraft Corporation's B-24 Liberator. On paper, the B-24 was comparable to the B-17, but for one major edge. It could fly literally all day without refueling. To the men, though, it left much to be desired. Flat-faced and rectangular, it had looks only a nearsighted mother could love. Crews called it the Flying Brick and the Constipated Lumberer, a play on Consolidated Liberator. The cockpit was oppressively cramped. Navigating the narrow catwalk could be difficult. One slip and you'd tumble into the bomb bay, which had fragile aluminum doors that would tear away with the weight of a falling man. The B-24's wheels had no steering, so when taxiing, the pilot had to coax the bomber along by powering one side's engines, then the other, and working the left and right brakes, one of which was usually more sensitive than the other. The taxiways were a pageant of lurching planes, all of which eventually veered into places nowhere near where their pilots intended them to go, and from which they often had to be dug with shovels. Flying the B-24, one of the world's heaviest planes, was like wrestling a bear. Because pilots strong-armed the yoke, the control lever, with their left hands, they were instantly recognizable when shirtless, because the muscles on their left arms dwarfed those on their right. The plane was so clumsy that it was hard to fly in tight formations without hitting other planes. It was also plagued with mechanical difficulties. If one of the four engines died, staying airborne was challenging. If two quit, it was an emergency. Early on, there were incidents in which B-24 tails fell off in midair. And the plane had a reputation for frailty, especially in the wings, which could snap off if struck in combat. Some men thought it was a death trap. When the 372nd Squadron's planes flew in, Phil's crew walked out to look. Louis heard someone mutter, "It's the flying coffin." For the next 3 months, the crew practically lived in their B-24. They flew in formation, fired at targets, and simulated combat runs. They buzzed so low over Iowa that the propellers kicked up a sandstorm, skinning the paint off the plane's belly and scouring the legs of Pillsbury sitting by the open tail hatch. Through it all, Louis perched in the glass-windowed greenhouse in the nose, bombing with superb proficiency. The squadron's prowess was soon well known. An angry farmer came calling after the 372nd's bombs flattened an outhouse. Training transformed Louis's crew. They worked together with seamless efficiency, and in the grim business of bombs and bullets, they were the squadron's best crew. The warmest praise would go to Phil. B-24s were built for tall pilots, and though small-statured Phil needed to sit on a cushion to get his feet to the pedals and his eyes over the control panel, he was, in Louis's words, a damn swell pilot, dealing with adversity with calm, adaptive acceptance. The surprise of this pliant pilot, Louis would learn, was that in a crisis, Phillips was as brave as they come. The cruise B-24 had its own personality. It oozed fuel into the bomb bay, inspiring Pillsbury's nervous habit of pacing around, sniffing the air. It loved venting deafening backfire.